one of the reasons I love talking about John Paul II today to people in your age in life is because increasingly you don't remember much about him. And if you do remember him at all, you know he was very old and not very vibrant at that time when you were little, right? Do some of you definitely remember seeing him like on the news or just pictures of him? They're very, very old. Yes. Oh, okay. Well, you're not all the same age, right? So John Paul II was in his prime, and especially right when he was elected, he was a very young pope. Unlike our present pontiff was elected as a much older man, John Paul II was elected as a very young pope. And if you haven't, and I didn't bring video footage for you, if you haven't, you know, do yourself a favor and dig up some of the old video footage of when he was a very young pontiff. He was a sportsman and an athlete. As I said, he was a soldier when he was young. And it's surprising, and I think after now we've had two very elderly pontiffs, the last two, you may just really enjoy that very much. So we now call John Paul the Great, right, which you know, and he his pontificate stretched from 78, so I was actually born in 76, so I was just a small baby when he was elected, so this is a long time, right, so most of my lifetime, to 2005. And underneath his pontificate, we can say, the church had the job of receiving and interpreting the teachings of the Second Vatican Council. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about the Second Vatican Council here, but that was something that John Paul II believed was part of his job, was to kind of bring those teachings out of the council, which had occurred, you know, really the council had closed 10 years before he became the pope, and he thought that people hadn't really heard the message of the council. So that's what he thought he was supposed to do. So he, for instance, really liked to quote from Gaudium et Spes, which is one of the documents of that council. Now, under John Paul II's pontificate, there were many great, during the time of his reign, there were many great calamities, but they were of a different nature from the kinds of things that the world experienced when John Paul II was, when he was young, right? So you know he grew up in Poland, which was a country that was sort of, depending on which time period you're looking at, sort of invaded from the east and from the west, right? So from either from Germany or from Russia, which was a very difficult way for him to grow up, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. But also, you know, so I want to, Caleb asked me to talk a little bit about John Paul's relationship to the teachings on the family. And it's interesting that if you were to read some of his writings on the family, you would have to say that he believed that the kind of liberalization of family life, if you will, putting that broadly, the spread of no-fault divorce, for instance, and widespread use of contraception. So he believed that this was kind of like a new threat that was sort of like the threats he had grown up with, right? That was like the spread of communism. And he used to say things like that. He also talked about the complete or the nearly complete elimination of religious education. So I don't know if any of you know these numbers off the top of your heads, but about 5% of the children in this country, and it would be much less than 5% in Europe, are attending religious schools. In 1900, that would have been very different, right? So, you know, just do the math, you know, 96-97% are in secular schools. So John Paul II thought that was really a terrible thing. So so he worried about these things. And so like the popes that came before him, he understood that you can't really easily separate out the different teachings on sort of economic matters, on sort of political life, and then the ones on family matters. So you can switch the slide. So this is about like saying, these are some of, do you know what an encyclical is? Yes, all of you do. So these are some of the earlier encyclicals. I'm pointing back to Pope Leo, Pope Pius XI, and then Pope Pius XI again. So the two on the outside, Rerum Novarum and Quadragesima, we think of those as economic encyclicals, yes?
I don't know what an encyclical is.
Okay, it's just a fancy word for a letter that a pope writes in which he teaches some things. So they teach on different topics. So the one on the far left was written by Pope Leo, and it was written on the condition of the working classes. It was kind of the first major anti-socialism statement of one of the popes. So the point here is that John Paul II, like Pope Leo, also recognized you don't do the economic encyclicals without also doing the family encyclicals, the teachings on the family, because they go together. And if you were to dig into them, you're going to find all of the time. If they're talking about economic matters or political matters, all of a sudden they'll change pace in the next paragraph and say, well, here's where the family comes into this. So these things are not separated out. Let's see, I think you can switch the slide again. Is there something? Okay, so this is another one of these examples. He was really fond of children, so you find lots of these sorts of pictures. So for this reason, I'm sure it's right to think about his teaching on one of his great letters on the family was called Familiaris Consortio. It's not wrong, I think, to think about it as like Rerum Novarum, which was the one written 100 years before by Pope Leo, where Rerum Novarum, which was anti-socialist, was written in response to sort of the problem of the working class, and it was aimed at the false solutions, like socialism is a false solution, right? In fact, I was at a lecture yesterday in Washington, D.C., where a guy from University of Maryland, he said, there's nothing socialism can't solve. Meaning this is not a thing of the past. There are currently people who think that socialism will solve all of our problems. But Pope Leo, 100 years ago, was sort of like, well, actually not really, is that going to help? And that's a different talk. But so the point is that John Paul II viewed, and he also wrote fairly forcibly against socialism and communism, but he also believed that the teachings on the family were just as important, right? And they were just as important for the, I don't know, the preservation of society, right? Like if socialism's a threat, the breakdown of the family is also a threat. And they, like, you're just not gonna fix anything without taking care of the family. So what I want to say before moving on to thinking about patriotism and his writings on patriotism is that one way to put it is that if you go back to those writings from the early popes on against socialism, one of the ways that they put it was, they put it as the great social question. They sometimes called it the social question, and it was the problem of, like, what do you do with the fact that there are different classes of people? Some are poor, some are wealthy. What are the obligations of the wealthy to the poor? And those early popes, Leo the 13th and Pope Pius the 11th, they kept articulating this. They would call it the great social question. So John Paul II was so interested in the problems that, like, to be honest, you could think of it as a revolution in family life that occurred with the spread of divorce. I mean, at the time when Pope Leo was writing about socialism, divorce was, like, not a thing that happened very much. I mean, it was not allowed in most European countries. There was major widespread agitation for it in Europe, but it was not legal in most places, not the way it is now. So John Paul II was pretty worried about this and talked about this a lot. Okay, next slide. So I don't know if you can see this. This is actually a picture of young Karol Wojtyła when he was in the army, when he was young. It's interesting that he wrote another letter, actually reflecting in Rerum Novarum. It's a passage in Centesimus Annus, is the letter that he wrote. It's kind of astonishing. So John Paul II, as you realize, he lived under two separate totalitarian regimes. This is when he was in the army, under the first one. He actually has this really interesting passage where he's reflecting back on the popes who warned against socialism. And now think, like, Pope Leo is writing against socialism in about 1890. So this is before Karol Wojtyła, like, is being oppressed by totalitarianism. And so when John Paul II looks back, he says, you know, it's really a shame people didn't pay attention to Pope Leo. And it's a funny thing he says, because, of course, like, the whole world suffers all this calamity because people don't take seriously that socialism is not the answer. But it's really powerful coming from a pope who personally suffered because people didn't take Pope Leo seriously, right? So he says in a letter he wrote in 1989 in Centesimus Annus, he says, we must acknowledge that its prophetic message, what Pope Leo said, was not accepted by people at the time. And then he says, for this reason, there ensued very serious tragedies, like, big understatement, right? Like, the spread of the international global spread of communism is, like, more than a serious tragedy, right? It's like a calamity. Okay, next slide. This is another picture of him working on a stone quarry when he was young. There are great, great photos of him. He's the shirtless guy with the scapular. So obviously he says these are serious tragedies. These are tragedies that he suffered personally, Karol Wojtyła. So what a statement by a living pontiff about the words of one of his predecessors, right? And it kind of makes you wonder, what is it that we, like 50 years now, will look back and think it's too bad we didn't pay closer attention to what maybe John Paul II wrote? I mean, you could pose yourself that question, right? So we might take away from this, like a note about, because of course John Paul II, I said, cared a lot about what's happening with the family, something about the prophetic character of Rerum Novarum. But this year that's just passed also was the 40th anniversary, not of the, the 50th anniversary of Humanae Vitae, which was the great letter which said, look, the birth control pill is also not gonna solve all of our problems. I mean, I'm putting it lightly, but that's more or less what it says. The church always taught that contraception is wrong, by the way, like always did forever. The important new thing that was in Humanae Vitae in 1968 was that the birth control pill in particular was wrong. We all know this? If not, you can ask me again at the end. I always say this because people think it was like we woke up and decided in 1968 that birth control was bad. I think so, I'm not sure. What did we say in 1968? How do we say this? But no, we always thought birth control was bad. It's just that when the pill came out, people weren't so sure if the pill wasn't just like taking an aspirin. Because taking an aspirin's not bad, right? So that was the question. They had to like spend some time and figure out whether, ethically speaking, taking the birth control pill is any different from taking an aspirin, right? So that was, I'll just leave that as a teaser. We can talk about it later. But that was what was decided in that. But it was basically ignored. And so John Paul II viewed that kind of ignoring of something that the popes are saying as the kind of thing we might worry later, like, gee, maybe some serious tragedies might occur, like if we just ignore these things. So I guess this is just to say so far, up till now, that it's really not so easy to get things right about what is being taught. Like, we have to kind of pay attention. Because the gospel, all of these letters that the popes are writing, these teachings, they're all related to the gospel. And the gospel is not an abstraction, right? It's not like, this is the best place to say this, because you guys know that when you're trying to do something for real, it has to make a claim on your whole life, right? It's like, it's not like a thing you could think about just on Sunday. You couldn't, become a good member of this academy just on Sundays, right? It's like a whole thing. There's a whole truth that you testify to. So John Paul II was kind of big on that. He also, that's one of the reasons he thought that it was really important to work with, so he founded World Youth Day, for instance. Like, he was the first pope to, he thought, younger people, I think he would still count me as young, but, so I don't want to say you guys. Those of us that are younger, he thought it was more important to preach to young people, because he thought it was young people who are more likely to see that it's important and possible to put your whole life into something. Because it's like what you naturally want to do when you're young. You just want to do the whole, you're all in, like whatever it is, good or bad, you're just going to be all in for it. So he thought that was a great feature of being young. So the next thing that I want to sort of propose to you is that this thing that the church does, this thing, she writes these letters through the popes, interpreting the long-standing 2,000-year-old history of the church in light of certain conditions. So like when socialism first became a big threat, you had this letter by Pope Leo, and then there's lots more letters about socialism through the ages. So this is, we call the social doctrine of the church, sometimes we call it the social magisterium of the church. This is something that I would like to propose we can't now easily interpret without John Paul II, that John Paul II's life is a kind of map or a kind of testimony. He's a great saint. He's someone who spent a lot of time writing about these social doctrines, that he gives us sort of special clues as to how to think about the social doctrine. And in particular, and this is going to be kind of a theme of the rest of the comments I'm going to make, in particular, he wants us to not think of the social teachings of the church, in fact, any of the teachings of the church, as kind of like ideas, abstractions. He wants us to think of everything as really imminent, like urgent and all-encompassing. And this is where I'm going to take us in the direction of this kind of thinking about patriotism, because patriotism requires a land. And so right now, I don't know how many of you are aware, but there's a kind of a contemporary debate going on in sort of Catholic circles about the extent to which we can embrace the founding principles of this country as Catholics. Because are the founding principles of this country Christian enough for us to embrace them? Now that's kind of, it's a debate I don't want to get into very much right now because I have to like update you on a bunch of stuff, it'd be too much. But what I'm about to say is the beginning. I'm trying to kind of work out a way into that argument because it's not a particularly Catholic principle that we wouldn't find a way to love our country, right? And so John Paul II was particularly, he was particularly as a pontiff in love with countries. So I don't know if you know this. He used to, when he landed in his own country, he would get out and kiss the ground. Have any of you traveled, you must have, away from your country? You come home and like, some of us, I mean, it happened to me only once. You come back and you're like, man, I just want to, you know, kiss the customs officer. I'm so glad to be back. But he would just get out and kiss the ground. But then he, as an example to other people, when he flew to other countries and he visited hundreds of countries, he would get out and kiss the ground in everybody's country. It was an example to us, right, that we're supposed to love the country. So that's what I want to sort of wrap up by talking about. So in June of 1979, so 40 years, was when he first went back to visit Poland after he became the Pope, right? So he was wanting to visit Poland in a time when Poland was under the control of the Soviet Union, right? So he had to get permission, and it was a very challenging thing to get permission. So you can flip that slide again. And this was a big deal. So this was the Pope's return to Poland. And that trip was a really interesting example of how he views the social magisterium. And I want to also, I want to draw out some lines from some of the speeches that he gave as examples of this kind of patriotism that he fostered. So here is, okay, one more slide. Here is, do I have this? Yeah. Here is a news article from the Washington Post in 1979. And the heading is Polish throngs hail the Pope. So like the Polish leaders, like the leaders of the Soviet regime that were stationed in Poland, they weren't excited, right? They were pretty upset about the Pope coming, but they were kind of caught. They had to let him come, but they also, I mean, there were just millions of police set up. But the Polish people, right, had been living under the Soviet Union for, you know, decades at this point. This is their, like, they haven't had a Polish Pope in their whole lifetime. I mean, it's not a normal thing to be a Polish Pope. And so they were very excited. So the story continued, you probably can't read it. Pope John Paul II arrived in Poland to welcome a profound yet dignified emotion from his countrymen and praise from the communist leadership that at least paid him lip service. And they said that he was a son of Poland and a man of peace. So the report continued and reported, this is before people understood that what he would do was kneel and kiss the ground in every country. It said that he knelt to kiss the ground at Okaci Airport when he arrived. And then he rode through the crowded streets of Warsaw in a carriage and conducted mass in Victory Square before 250,000 people. It's a lot of people. And that the Pope was moved and he called this a personal pilgrimage. So I want to think about the language of pilgrimage because I think this is how John Paul II understood patriotism. So I have another slide that is just a random slide of a very old picture of a pilgrimage. So how many of you ever tried to go on a pilgrimage at all? Almost nobody. It's not a thing people do anymore. One person, sort of. Everyone's like, who did that? Look around. So the 1913 Catholic Encyclopedia, which you probably don't have on your desk, defines a pilgrimage as a journey that you make to some sort of place with the purpose of venerating the place, right? So it's, in other words, it's a journey you make to a holy place, a place you think of as holy, right? So it seems, I was doing some research to figure out what the origin of this, but it seems that it goes very far back and that it was, that the idea of a pilgrimage didn't even necessarily originate under any of the religions that we're all aware of. It was like an ancient human tradition. So primitive peoples would travel to the birthplace of like gods or heroes, like, you know, heroes in war, and they would go back and honor the place where a hero in war was born. And so the Catholic Encyclopedia has this idea in it. It's a long article, and it says something like, it's interesting that now we think of a pilgrimage as something deeply within the Christian tradition, and it was certainly around in the Judeo-Christian tradition as well. It says something like, isn't it interesting that God put in the human heart the desire to go venerate holy places, kind of even before Jesus was born, and then we would want to go back and venerate Bethlehem, where he was born. And now would we also like to go to places where saints were born, and we go to places where we think the Blessed Mother maybe appeared, right? And we venerate these places, and that's what a pilgrimage is. So this is something that is pretty natural to us. So when John Paul II went to Poland, now you can flip this again, he basically said, I'm here as a pilgrim. So he was kind of identifying his own natural country as the kind, I mean, of course it was his birthplace. He wasn't saying, well, I'm a holy person. He was saying, this is my birthplace and it's worthy of veneration, in part because it's mine. But of course he also says, in part because it's Christian. He says, this is a Christian country. This is a Christian nation. That is what the crowd looked like at that mass that I was telling you about. There's 250,000 people. This is why the Soviet administrators were worried, right? Like, they were very worried. So in this mass, he always used the language of love regarding his country and his countrymen. So he said, beloved fellow countrymen, I'm here as a pilgrim, he said. I'm going to kind of skip through this so it doesn't take too long. I'm here as a pilgrim, and he said, you know that the pope that just died before me, Paul VI, well, the one before that, Paul VI was the first pilgrim pope. He wanted to come to Poland and make a pilgrimage, but basically the Soviet government said he couldn't go, so he was prevented. And he said in this mass, he said, I think that God prevented Paul VI from going to Poland, you know, sort of put an obstacle in his way, because God knew that a Polish pope was coming. And it would be really great to have a Polish pope go visit Poland, right? And you know, Poland isn't just a Christian country, Poland is a Catholic country. So the pope then said, he said, yeah, so we thank divine providence for having given Paul VI this desire, and then I could sort of finish it off, like I finished what he wanted to start, what he couldn't finish. So that is Paul VI, and that is John Paul II. So this is before John Paul II became pope. He spent many years in the Vatican before he became the pope. So he said, why did Paul VI want to go to Poland? He wanted to go in 1966. Remember, John Paul II became pope in 78. Paul VI wanted to go in 66 because it was the millennial anniversary of the baptism of Poland. Poland became Catholic in 966, so it was 1,000 years. And so he was unable to go in 1966, right? So John Paul II basically says this. He says, well, it's too bad that he wasn't able to go. But see, instead of criticizing the Soviets, he said, well, it must have just been God's providence. In other words, like, chuckle, chuckle, chuckle. God knew that a Polish pope was coming. So he says to the people, he says, today was granted to me to fulfill what Paul VI wanted. After the death of Paul VI, I became the pope, he says, and then I immediately understood, as soon as I became the pope, that I was supposed to carry out his mission to Poland. I was supposed to go there on a pilgrimage. So he describes himself then as the pilgrim pope. So what I want to say now, and this is like maybe the most difficult part of this talk, is I want to connect this together with what I said before. So what is this social doctrine which is supposed to tell us about how we're supposed to live out Christian principles in the world? I said it wasn't supposed to be abstract. It wasn't supposed to be like a thing that's just, you know, like in our heads someplace. So Pope Leo, the one that was 100 years ago, he said at the beginning of Rerum Novarum that the remedy or the solution for what's miserable and what's wretched in society, what is worst for the poor people, he says that there is a solution. And of course he says, it's not socialism, that's not the solution. But he says, well, actually the church has the solution. And he says, what is the solution? He says, well, basically, it's a kind of, it's a paradigm for the church where the church basically comes and says, look, the only way to make things better is to provide a path for like, I'll paraphrase it, for Jesus Christ to reign, but not just sort of like in a political sense, like for him to reign in people's hearts. Like, that's actually the only solution. But that doesn't, again, that's not an idea. It's not like, or it's not merely an idea, it's an idea, but it happens through grace, right? So that's like the big G, it happens through grace. The grace is actual. There's a wonderful video of John Paul, so this is what I mean, he really didn't think, he really wanted people not to think this was all in your head, like an idea, merely. There's a wonderful video where he says, people don't realize that Jesus Christ is still actual. And he kind of, he has this huge, his face lights up with this huge smile. It's as if like he just saw him, right? Like he's just here to tell you, like he's over there in another room. You know, and of course, in reality, we know that Jesus is over there in another room, right? But it's difficult for us to sort of make that, to make that as imminent for ourselves as it was. But clearly for the saint, it was very imminent. So he wanted us to understand, like Jesus Christ is actual. He uses this word, he uses the word actual in English. I don't know what the word would have been in Polish, but this particular video I'm thinking of, he's speaking in English. So it's like he's looking for the right word and he comes up with actual. I don't know if that's the best word, but it's like he wants you to, maybe he wants to say real. So he says in, he says then, John Paul II then says in this letter he writes about Pope Leo, he says, Pope Leo offered this like plan for the church. He said that the church has something to say about specific human situations, individual and communal, national and international, that she formulates a kind of teaching, a body of teaching for these situations. And so he basically says, look, this is about judging things rightly. But then he says, he moves on and he says, right after the passage I just quoted, he says, now look, to understand Pope Leo properly, we have to realize this. He says, in Pope Leo's time, a concept of the church's like obligations in society was far from being admitted. In other words, the church was already at that time sort of like, call it something like a misplaced idea of church, like the separation of church and state. Like we thought more or less like the church has its role. It's over there on Sunday. Like it's already kind of been pushed out of its proper kind of citizenship. So the Pope, so John Paul II says, a twofold approach prevailed, twofold. One, which is like directed at this world and this life, where faith stays extraneous, like on the margin, we can say on Sunday or whatever. And the other is directed towards an otherworldly salvation. So this is the Sunday, the thing you do on Sunday in your head, like, oh, well, you know, at some point I'm going to be saved, or at some point I'm going to work towards that. Like, I know I'm supposed to be good, but it doesn't really like bite. It doesn't really, like, you wake up in the morning, nothing's different about your day. Like, you look the same as everybody else. He was worried that already in Pope Leo's times, 100 years ago, when you're battling socialism, that's already the problem, is that there's like a false separation for even for Christians, right? Between your faith and your regular real life. And he thought that's the problem right there. Like that's just a, and that's in all of the different things that he was thinking about, like the socialism problem, the communism problem, the family problem, the divorce problem, the contraception problem. It's always the same thing. It's like, well, maybe there's these abstract principles that work on Sunday, but like today, what I'm gonna do with my body, what I'm gonna do with my marriage, what I'm gonna do with my kids, what we're gonna do with the political life, like God has nothing to say about that, right? That's what, like if I had to sum up, that's the thing he was constantly trying to say is like no way, it's like a foul. It's like a foul move, right? Like you, just it's invalid, it doesn't count. So he said this in lots of different ways. So here's where we're going to get real again, thinking about Pope John Paul II's life. So around the time of the communist occupation of Poland, this is a picture of the, I don't know if you can see it, it's actually the destruction of a church bell. So when the communists occupied Poland between 1947 and 53, which is right after World War II, right? One of the things that they were really concerned about, and you can flip to the next slide, this is a picture of a public execution of priests. The communists thought that you basically had to get rid of the Catholic Church because the Catholic Church was like another pole of leadership, right? And you just need to wipe out the other pole of leadership. So they did everything that they could to sort of minimize and eliminate the Catholic Church. So the church became the prime target of persecution. The communist government then undertook a series of campaigns aimed at not just eliminating priests and religious sisters, for instance, but also getting rid of the presence of Catholicism within culture. So like it would have been very common for there to be like crosses on the wall inside of schools, but like inside of grocery stores, for instance, and hospitals and places that we don't think of as normally having crosses today. But if you're in a Catholic country, why would you not have a cross on the grocery store? So they went around and collected up all these things. And so the church bells were destroyed and all this stuff was ruined. The communists called this a policy of disintegration. So they wanted to disintegrate Catholicism from people's ordinary everyday lives, right? So a test for whether or not we understand this idea of the two-prong approach that John Paul II thought was so bad was to ask yourself this question. Why do we feel bad for the Poles when this is happening? So I always ask my students this, and they always say more or less some version of the same thing. And you guys are much smarter, so you won't say this, and I won't ask you. But the answer is not because their rights are being violated. Now, obviously, bad things are happening to them. You can say that. We just feel bad for anybody where bad things are happening to them. But the reason we feel sorry is not because their rights are being violated, and not because their religious freedom is being violated. It is. Their rights are being violated. Those things are true things. But John Paul II would have added something. And he would have said, if you've understood my message, there's another reason you should feel bad for the Poles. And that reason is because, wait for it. If you're John Paul II, you think that there ought to be crosses on the wall in the grocery store. Because say, most Americans don't think that. And he's not necessarily saying that's like a policy for everywhere. But he's saying you're a Catholic people, and Jesus Christ is the center of history. There ought to be like religious images in public. So John Paul II said in that same mass with the 250,000 people, he said the following thing. He said, Christ cannot be kept out of the history of man, not in any part of the globe and any place. He said, the exclusion of Christ from the history of man is an act against man. So this is like a pretty intense thing to say. Like it's a fairly intense thing to say, right? The exclusion of Christ from the history of man is an act against man. So he says, without Christ, it's impossible to understand the history of Poland. So he says this in the square. And this is, the people are going crazy when he's saying this. They're just, you know, they've been not able to practice their religion freely, and he comes and he says these things, and everybody's really excited about it. So this is what he thinks is going on. The reason he wants us to feel sorry for that culture that he grew up in is because he doesn't think anybody's going to do well. Like, society won't thrive. It won't get better. The poor will not have a path to improvement without sort of an explicit relationship with Christ. That's what he thinks. So actually with that mass, after he says some of these things that I quoted to you, there was a point in the homily when he was speaking and the crowd started chanting, we want God, we want God. So this is really interesting, right? Because nobody would do that here. We have like all of this freedom, like compared to the people living under the Soviet regime. And yet, like, I mostly get the impression nobody thinks like we want God, right? So this is really, but that's just an example of how perverse human nature is, right? That when you're denied something that you should have, that you appreciate it more, right? And we're not denied this in general, but we don't appreciate it very much, right? Just we're all perverse human beings. Yeah. All right. So the next slide. Maybe more. Okay. So this guy on the left is Lech Walesa. He was the electrician who became the leader of this resistance movement in Poland, who was inspired by John Paul II. He said in those years, it was kind of, he had a lot of really dramatic comments. I don't know if this is the one, this is not the one. There was another one. He said, we used to grow up drinking anti-communism in our mother's milk. Great. But in this one, he said, if you chose the example of what we Poles have in our pockets and in our shops, then communism did very little for us. But if you chose the example of what is in our souls, well, I say that communism has done very much for us. In fact, our souls contain the opposite of what they, the Soviets, wanted. They wanted us not to believe in God, but our churches are full. They wanted us to be materialistic and incapable of sacrifice. They wanted us to be afraid of tanks and guns, but instead we don't fear them at all. Now, I mean, some people probably did fear them, but he was the leader of a movement that was a resistance movement, and people just said, hey, this is what he said. Yeah, I'm right behind him, right? So the struggle for freedom in Poland was identified with the religious identity of the Poles. Right? So that's really important. Like, the struggle for freedom is identified with the religious identity of the Poles. I want to make, just to wrap up, two minutes, I think, maybe three. I want to make sort of three points about, three points about why this teaching that John Paul II says about the rejecting the dualism of life, like this kind of split life. Most of you are here, you're trying not to live the split life. So, I mean, I know you've already rejected the idea of the split life, right? We're all trying to do that. But I have three final points. The first is that the project of the living out of the church's teaching in public life, which is really anywhere you live and work and breathe and do your job, right? All the more so for members of the military, is a religious project, not in the sense that like everything that you do, your commitments in the military are religious, but they're built on a religious impulse, right? Which is an impulse of piety. So in the modern political state, right, the separation of church and state, that's not a bad thing. But then the question is, where does the church have its impact? If she's not, like, if the church is not united with the state, which we say that's a good change, right? And the church thinks that's a good change. Where does she have her impact? Well, she has to have her impact through you, right? So you become the instrument through which the church can reach new souls and sanctify things, right? That's really important, right? Because there used to be a time in Italy, for instance, in any Catholic country, when to be baptized, when you were baptized, you became simultaneously baptized, member of the community, but also the citizen of the state. That was how closely aligned these things were. But we know this isn't the case now. So then the primary question is how to protect the sphere of action for the church. This is why it becomes really important to start to think about, well, what does it mean to be a lay person in the church? Like, it's not the job of the priest, actually, to sort of do all of the work of the church. That's a certain, like, mistake that people used to have. So that's the first point. There you go. So I remember I told you that he likes to show up and kiss the ground. So it's a nice example of that. I mean, he really did this everywhere. Have you ever tried kissing the ground? No, see, you're all laughing. Have you ever just tried to do it once? Try to do it once. The reason I say that is because I wouldn't say humiliating, but it's a very humbling thing to do. Like, we don't kiss people's feet very often. I mean, if you do, I'd be worried about you. but kissing something low to the ground, it's an act of real piety, right? It's like you're humble before something much bigger than yourself, right? So this is something that teaches us to think of our relationship with our own country and our relationship with the land that belongs to us as a relationship with something that's holy, right? So the religious project of the pilgrim who gets up and he goes on this pilgrimage, right, is a relationship with a specific land that is holy. And John Paul II kissed the ground in Poland. It was his motherland, but because he kissed all the grounds, he didn't say you can only kiss the ground in places where your country's perfect. So it's really important. It's not like you can't kiss the ground if your country has some flaws or some things that need to be improved. That's actually really important. So he kissed the ground in communist countries, he kissed the ground in Muslim countries, he kissed the ground like in democratic republics like ours. And in this sense, the pilgrim begins with the same impulse that the patriot has. So remember Patrick Henry says, I regret that I have but one life to give for my country. John Paul II would definitely have wanted to make the same play, right? Like, it's too bad I have only one life to live, like as a Pole. He would have liked to have lived it twice as a Pole, right? So in consequence of that, this is kind of putting the point a little bit differently. John Paul II thought that every country was worth dying for, like even a not perfect country. And he said this as much. He said, he actually said in this country, one of his visits here, he said, to build a free society with liberty and justice for all, one must, must be constantly renewed, like this commitment, if the United States is going to fulfill the destiny to which the founders pledged their lives and fortunes and sacred honor. So he was a big fan of this. So the last thing I want to say about pilgrimage, I said I think I had 3 points, that's the last point, and you can go one last slide, is that for John Paul II, I think, you know, yes, this is the Black Madonna. Has everyone seen a picture of the Black Madonna? So the Black Madonna is the great Marian shrine in Poland. She's venerated all over the place, and she's venerated for having essentially helped Poland defend herself under a Swedish attack in 1656. So John Paul II basically thought that you were attached to the land that you love, like the land that we're supposed to venerate, through your mother, which makes a lot of sense, right? Because you're born in a certain place. You're born in a certain place, and your birth and your family and the family ties that you have attach you. You can't do that without a connection to your mother. It's interesting, we also think of the church as our mother. So for John Paul, it was a very Marian pope in this sense. So the pilgrim church, John Paul II often said it was a pilgrim church. And he said that that Mary is the first pilgrim, and so we're supposed to follow her as the star of the sea, Maris Stella. And so essentially, like, to sum that point up, John Paul II would have said, if you want to be a good patriot, if you want to be a good pilgrim patriot, that devotion to the Blessed Mother is not sort of an option. It's not an option. It's a requirement. You're going to have to do it, because you're going to have to be close to a mother, to your mother, in order to kind of understand yourself as living out this attachment to like something physical. Otherwise, it's just in your head, right? It's just an abstract principle. Who's your mother, right? That's something he used to say. And I'm going to stop there. I have passages from his prayer before the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Poland. There's a beautiful tomb there. But it is too long, so I'm going to stop there. But we have 10 or 15 minutes for questions.
Yes? Could you speak to JP2's role in consecrating Russia to the Blessed Virgin and then the ultimate collapse of the Soviet Union shortly thereafter?
So yes and no. Yes and no, because you know that part of this is secret. So this is connected to the promises that were reported to have been made by the Blessed Mother to the children in Fatima. Does everyone know about this? The three little children. There are three little children, Portuguese children, who we believe saw the Blessed Mother speak to them in Portugal when they were quite little, and this is in 1913. I was going to say 17. Yeah.
So do you think you made 13?
It's right before the First World War starts, and so the three children. It's the 13th day of the month, that's right. So for several months consecutively, they saw the Blessed Mother, and she said many things to them, many things that the Blessed Mother said to them, they just reported to everybody, and that got them into trouble. But other things that she said to them were just, she asked them to keep secret. And this is why it's a little bit hard. So what we think we understand is that, so the two younger of the children died when they were quite young, and the oldest of the children lived to be an old age as a religious sister. And she was the one who kept those secrets, and she was sort of told, well, at some point you're good. So what we believe was the content of some of those secrets is that they were told, like, if Russia is not consecrated, that, you know, terrible things will happen in Russia. And so it's what we understand is that John Paul II believed these secrets, and that she was authorized to tell them to the Holy Father. But this, to my knowledge, this has not been written down. But he he believed this, and he went and did say these prayers of consecration. But that is as much as I know. That is as much as I know. But we know that under the beginning of his papacy, which is when this happened for the first time, right? I didn't walk you through the history of this. That visit to Poland is sort of the beginning of the end for Soviet Russia. So certainly you could believe that he, by kind of saying these prayers of consecration, by paying attention to this, that he was cooperating with God's grace and helping to bring about the end of the Soviet regime. I think that we're free to think that. But yeah, it's a little bit difficult because it was sort of secret. Yes.
Could you reiterate why he kissed the ground at every country he visited?
Yeah. So he kissed the ground everywhere because he believed that it was okay. Let me back up. All right. So you know, like we think about the. We use the word the tree huggers for a minute. I don't know if there's any tree huggers in here. Probably not, but you know what I mean. You know who the tree huggers are, right? The people are like, you know, the earth is our mother and she's angry, you know, that sort of thing. Or she's whatever. I think that one way to think about it is that John Paul thought that actually there's something right about the impulse of the tree hugger, so to speak, except that he did it very differently. The impulse is sort of... that the way, that nature, like nature, our physicality, our human bodies, but also like the trees, and he was a great outdoorsman. He spent lots and lots of his free time hiking, skiing. I kept stressing this point. He didn't think that Christianity or the way to even think about what it meant to be a human being was something you could do. Like, we're not angels. So angels never had bodies, right? Angels never had bodies. They have personhood, like they were created by God. They're not human persons, right? But they never had bodies. But we have bodies, and we were given an earth, right? And we have all this stuff. And what's really interesting about the Christian faith is that not just that like God created us and he wants us to be in relationship with him, but that relationship is mediated. Do you know what a mediator is? Like a mediator? Like if we're having a big argument, and we called on him, we're like, can you, like, we're about to punch each other out. We need somebody to, like, work it out between us, right? That's a mediator. The mediator of our relationship with God and with is actually the physicality of the universe, right? So this is why our bodies are sacred. The ground is sacred, right? Things are sacred. And then, of course, the impulse of the Christian faith is always to sort of cooperate with God in helping to make nature in some ways more sacred, right? Like your body is already sacred when it's born. It's a creation of God. It was like you were baptized in the sacrifices of your mother. Like all of that's already sacred. But then you get baptized, right? So then your body becomes even more sacred. People who become priests, their bodies, their hands become even more, like there's a process of becoming more and more sacred, more and more sanctified. So some places are already, just like when you were born, they're already holy, and we should think about them that way because they belong to us and they were given to us and they're beautiful. So it's like when you were born, you're already that way. But then other places become even more sacred, right? Because why? Because say somebody really important died on that place. Like, so as we think of like going to Gettysburg, going to places where soldiers died, you're like, I don't think we should step on this ground. It's really like that impulse. For John Paul II, that impulse is a way to think about all of creation, right? And so he wanted us to start, in some sense, from the ground up. Like if he could have, and he did, he kissed a lot of people in crowds when he would go bless people. A lot of times he would grab you by the head and kiss your head, right? Too much of that would be too much. But as if to make the point really, really to drive it home, every time he got into a new country, he would kiss that ground. But he wanted us to do that. I think he would have said we don't take enough of the beauty and the sacredness of nature. We take too much of it for granted. We just like walk around and we don't like run around skipping and singing all the time. Like, hey, have you ever seen that tree? That tree is amazing. Right? But in some ways, like that's kind of how we should view nature all the time. And obviously, you gotta like live your life. You can't be on some sort of nature ecstasy all the time, right? But that, you know, if you're always aware that that's a possible way to live. It's so some of the saints will call that like the romance of everyday life. It's always available to us to view every sunset as a like a love letter from God, right? I mean, there's that, right?
Guys,
I think you guys have
that, yeah,
I think
but
you guys
give
have
it
something
up
else.
Time.
Yeah.